Court. I'm Stephen Spence, on behalf of the appellant of Phillips Goldman & Spence in Wilmington, Delaware. With me at council table is my son, Stephen Spence, who gave considerable effort on the briefs in this matter, but I'll be making the argument.
When your name's mentioned, it's customary to stand. Thank you. Welcome.
And our briefs were presented in a particular fashion that I would like to change the order of my presentation briefly to focus on what I consider to be the most serious issue before the court, which is our appeal of the award of punitive damages. And if I may, I'd like to briefly go through that. The affiliate and manager privilege argument that was made as our initial argument flows in some way from that, so I thought I'd try to talk briefly about punitive damages first. Your Honors, this case is a landlord-tenant dispute that has gotten to this level, and it's somewhat unfortunate that we're here, really. But the principal dispute, I believe, is the ultimate question of whether or not a landlord has a vested interest in the liquor license of its tenant at a location, because at its heart, the one finding by the trial judge that gave rise to his conclusion that a punitive damage award might be appropriate was some language he used in his opinion to suggest that my client group was aware of how important it was to have a liquor licensed facility at the licensed or at the leased premises. But prior to the trial judge's determination in the Superior Court case, the parties had been litigating with each other in multiple forums. They had been before the Court of Chancery. They had been before the Delaware Alcoholic Beverage Control Commissioner. And in the Chancery Court proceeding, which is, for purposes of this case, I think, law of the case, because it was litigated there and then transferred to Superior Court after the court found that it didn't have substantive jurisdiction, because it declined to specifically enforce the lease by requiring the tenant to stay in that location as a licensed operator under the ABCC laws. And it also found against the plaintiff landlord on the claim that it had some special property interest in the license due to the language in the lease that required a continuous operation of the facility as a liquor store. Once the Chancery Court declined to grant any form of injunctive relief in the form of either, well, initially in the case of the plaintiff's efforts to stop the Alcoholic Beverage Control Commissioner from having his public hearing on the now appellee's protest of the request to move the license. Then the ABCC proceedings went forward. Our landlord came before the ABCC, protested the application for the request for to move the license premises, and that protest was denied. The plaintiff here, the appellee, appealed that determination and got an adverse ruling from an appeal panel that's created by statute. It's an administrative appeal panel created by statute under Title IV. And so at the Chancery Court, at the ABCC, and the appeal from that ABCC determination, in each case, the permission to move the licensed premises from the existing landlord-tenanted location to the store next door, the larger store, were approved in public proceedings for which the landlord had notice, protested, and lost.
Both of those proceedings, the one before the Court of Chancery and then the one after that before the Alcoholic Beverage Commission, occurred after Mr. Patel had sold his stock to Mr. Pyres?
That's correct. And the stock, well, I mean, I apologize for not knowing whether this is in the record, but the stock sale itself was not contingent. It was not contingent on those approvals. It was a stock sale, permission by the ABCC for the sale, because that's a requirement as well, was granted without contest. Mm-hmm. In fact, in fairness to the landlord, I don't think notice to the landlord was even required under the statute. But that all occurred in November, and the various proceedings I just described occurred in the several months
okay.
after that.
And then the Alcoholic Beverage Commission grants the license to Mr. Pyres or his entities or both to operate a liquor store next door?
There was an application for permission to move the location of the license next door. That's correct.
And they did.
And they did.
And at that point, the old store was essentially shut down by the tenant.
It was. Rent was paid through September of 2009, which was...
All but the last 6 months on the lease, correct?
No, it was a much longer period than that. The rent was paid continuously. The approvals that I referred to were granted in the first and second quarter of 2009. The final approval of the Alcoholic Beverage Control Commissioner to approve the movement was early April of 2009. Rent was paid through September of 2009. The Chancery Court final order of dismissal was in July of 2009. And the demand by the landlord that the premises be returned was in September of 2009. And in
when Mr. Pyres surrendered the keys to the old liquor store to the landlord,
his rent was current.
The rent was current.
Correct.
And then at some point the rent stopped getting paid.
That's correct.
And I'm just asking how many months of unpaid
rent?
There
were 23 months left, I believe, or 22 and a half months left in the lease.
All right. And the court, at that point, there was a superior court action for damages was filed and prosecuted.
It coincidentally, because of the Chancery Court determination of the need to transfer, it was actually filed before the premises possession was returned, but then it was prosecuted after
that. And that led to a judgment against all of these defendants for the back rent.
That's correct.
For $25,000 in punitive damages and for a portion of the attorney's fees that were requested.
That's correct. And the finding that I was trying to get myself to temporarily was in the trial judge's opinion on page 28 of his opinion. It says the defendants had a plan to open a large liquor store in the Salvation Army building. No dispute about that. The Shore's lease with Behold prevented them from doing that until the expiration of the lease on August 31st, 2011. Now, our response to that in our appeal is that, no, the Chancery Court ruled that it wasn't going to specifically enforce the lease, and we couldn't have done anything about moving without the ABCC's permission, but we got that permission, and we did all that publicly. And then the next sentence, unwilling to wait until then and knowing full well how important it was to Shore to have an operating liquor store on its premises.
Well, I'm trying to focus on what is an issue.
Yes.
Is it correct that that part of the judgment that awarded the back rent to the landlord you're not appealing from?
We did appeal, Your Honor, from one segment of it. There was no dispute about the finding of breach of lease and an award of damages through the time of trial, except that we claimed the evidence in the record below for a period of time between of February or March of 2010 to the trial date was insufficient on the question of mitigation of damages.
In other words, you don't argue that the rent shouldn't have been paid or that it wasn't owing, but rather that there should have been mitigation, and it wasn't owing for that reason, not because the lease didn't require it.
That is correct. And then there's one other sub-issue in that post-trial in March of 2011, there were still 5 or 6 months left on the lease, and there was no acceleration provision in the lease, and so we contend as a matter of law that you can't award damages for rent that had not yet accrued as of the time of trial, and that's a 5.5 month period.
Well, Ken, as I understand part of your argument on punitive damages is that the magic words were not used to define the conduct. Is that correct?
Well, yes, number one. And two, that the words that were used, and I had just about finished reading that sentence, and I'll finish reading that sentence. The words that were used were, again, I'll just repeat it, unwilling to wait until then and knowing full well how important it was to Shore to have an operating liquor store in its premises, the defendants intentionally and willfully caused Behold to breach its lease by moving the liquor store from the lease premises to the Salvation Army building. Now, there's no dispute on our part that we did so after making applications before the government agency with jurisdiction and defending a Chancery Court action, suggesting that we did not have that right, and that action being dismissed with the ruling in our favor that the court was not going to assert any jurisdiction to specifically enforce those two provisions, paragraphs 10 and 11. But the trial judge basically goes back to that same connecting piece that we keep saying, no, they're not connected, which is we had a right to apply for a movement of the liquor license to an adjacent building. We made that application. It was opposed. We were successful. It was appealed. We were successful. To come back to a finding in Superior Court that the decision to make that application, knowing that it would be a breach, it's understood. We disputed at trial whether it was a breach, but we lost that argument that we took the position it was a matter of public policy that the provision.
Right, it's an efficient breach.
Yes, and we took the position at trial that it was, as a matter of public policy, not a breach because it would be inappropriate for a landlord to be able to dictate to the alcoholic beverage control.
Right, but you're not arguing that now.
No, we're not. We did not appeal that. But then to connect the two and say, because the landlord wanted to keep it there, even though we didn't have a legal right to it, that caused us to be liable for punitive damages is what we claim is, whether it's lack of sufficient evidence or clear error, because the standard, we were having trouble figuring out what the correct standard for review of this award is. But
are you arguing that the whatever finding the chancellor made in declining injunctive relief somehow forecloses any further inquiry into the bona fides of Mr. Peary's intent? I mean, I don't know why you're connecting these two.
Well, I think the answer is because the chancellor said in his opinion that legal argument that the lease.
Are you arguing that the chancery opinion forecloses any finding that would have led or could have led to a punitive damage award?
As it relates to the fact of having how important it was to have a liquor store operating in the landlord's premises,
is
yes.
Is that a collateral estoppel type argument? Because if it is, I don't recall seeing it in your brief.
We didn't brief it as such. I think what we were saying is that the conduct, which that we do argue,
are arguing is that on the factual record in the Superior Court case, there's not sufficient evidence to establish the state of mind that would justify
that's correct
damages.
And that we did argue the what I'd call the efficient breach theory, that it's a contract. We took the risk that there may be a breach, but we didn't do anything that was illegal. We didn't do anything that was with a malintent.
I understand all that,
for permission to
but
do
that those arguments are based on this record, not upon what happened or didn't happen in the Court of Chancery.
Well, if for no other reason, I would suggest that it helps with our argument of our client's state of mind, that he did all the things that he thought he was required to do, seek permission to do it, got approval to do it, and then was called upon the carpet for doing it as if he had done something that was willful or wanton or egregious or illegal. In the appellee's briefs, they use the term bribe, which is totally uncalled for.
Is it your position that taking the words that the trial judge used, defendants intentionally and willfully caused Behold to breach its lease, that as a matter of law is insufficient for punitive damages?
In a contract case, yes. And in this particular context where the appellee has brought all these parties together in a argument of a, you know, the intentional interference with.
But what about in a tortious interference case? Is it as a matter of law insufficient?
In this case, we believe it is, yes, given all the facts in the record, yes.
All right, so we're basically to say that there was a clearly erroneous finding?
Well, the only finding that we have is the one I read, and it may have been important to Shore to have a liquor store in its premises, but it didn't have that legal right. That was a finding, and even if we don't argue collateral estoppel, it's clearly a belief on our client's part that he had done all the things that he was required to do, and he had judicial and administrative review of both, and no one
okay,
found
but that's a factual argument. That is, you're using the chancery, the result in the chancery case is evidence or further evidence that your client didn't have the state of mind that would support a punitive damage award.
That's
distinguished from a legal argument based on collateral estoppel.
That's correct. But to suggest all the cases that we reviewed and argued in our briefs about punitive damages, in our view, related to conduct where there was some sort of misrepresentation, some sort of fraud, some sort of grossly negligent conduct.
That brings us to an argument that the other side is making, which is that Mr. Patel, the original owner of the stock of the entity that owned the small liquor store, which is the subject of the lawsuit, represented or misrepresented to the landlord that he would not deal with Mr. Perry's, and then went on and did so. What's the state of the factual record on that claim?
It's very thin, and I'm in my sum-up period, by the way, and I foolishly failed to reserve the time, so I'll just keep going. But the factual record is, I think, one sentence, which I'm not even sure I understand when you read it. Mr. Jones is testifying about a question about what conversation he had with him, and he talks about being best buddies with him and no, but I'm not even sure what that meant in the record.
There is some testimony by Mr. Jones.
Correct.
Right? No testimony by Mr. Patel because he never appeared.
That's correct.
And that's the sum and substance of
The other record testimony is testimony from Mr. Pyres about the circumstances surrounding small liquor stores and this particular liquor store and Mr. Patel's desire to leave the marketplace of owning a liquor store.
I understand that, but that's Mr. Pyres wasn't...
He would have had no knowledge about any alleged misrepresentation, Mr. Pyres. And that's with respect to that record, what I think the appellants are trying to do is take the judge's findings, suggest they're erroneous, but from his own review of his trial record, and then I think, even though we're not Mr. Patel's counsel, somehow using it against us. We weren't real sure in the briefing exactly what was coming out of that, but we think that the record on that is inadequate, or is adequate, excuse me, based on Pyrie's comments, but inadequate as it relates to what Mr. Jones claimed was the misrepresentation.
You did, by the way, reserve in advance some rebuttal time. If you want to stop now, you can, and you'll have 2.5 minutes left.
Unless the court has any other questions for me, the main issue for me was the punitive damage. The other thing, I think things are all well briefed, but I don't have any other comments unless the court has questions for me until rebuttal.
Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is John Sergovic, and I'm with the firm of Sergovic, Carmine, and Wideman in Georgetown. We represent the Appalachian Shore Investment. With me as co-counsel is Elizabeth Suchek, and my client, Mr. Jones, is also here. Joe, thank you. Let me start off by commenting that approximately somewhere between 75% or 65% of what's been brought before this court was not fairly brought below. I'm calling them the avoidance, the tortious interference claim, basically affiliate privilege and manager's privilege, were not raised below.
Mr. Sergovic, could you move the microphone closer? I might have trouble hearing you.
I'm sorry. Okay, I'm saying that primarily those two avoidance defenses were not raised per se below. The tactical breach.
I'm not sure what you mean by not raised per se below. Were they raised?
They were not raised at all.
The question for us is, were they fairly presented to the trial judge?
No, they were not.
Oh, that's okay. I don't understand the per se. What we focus on is, did the trial judge have an opportunity to rule on those issues? And your answer is, he did not.
He did not. Right. He was never presented with either of those two. He was not presented with the tactical breach theory. He was not presented with the rationale behind the other jurisdictions' rulings that without an acceleration clause, you can't. He didn't have any of the rationale behind that rule. It was just they were just cited a broad rule. With respect to the mitigation of damages, another example, the opening statement of trial counsel had two lines saying, what I'm going to present in evidence is three failures to mitigate. They presented that. They didn't raise any of the other mitigation things like failure to reduce the rent, failure to take the cooler out, and my client had factual justification for not doing that. But the other things the appellants have not
Mr.
done.
Mr. Zergovich, before you go on, I'm trying to, I guess, understand the precise arguments the positions that your side took and the basis for the trial judge's ruling. And what I'd like to do, if my colleagues will permit me, is just ask you a couple of hypothetical questions.
Certainly.
Let's assume that the original tenant, which is Mr. Patel, you know, who owned the stock of the entity that that actually owned and operated the small liquor store, had continued to operate it even though they weren't making money until the expiration of the lease, at which point he hands back the keys to the liquor store.
We conceded that below.
I understand that. These are hypothetical. Let's assume that was the case. That is, there was no transfer of ownership and there was no breach of the lease. Would there be any financial or damage consequence at that point?
No, I mean that we can see.
Who would be entitled to return the premises to the landlord, even though it might be a white elephant, and even though the landlord might end up with a property that was not marketable without a lot of new investment?
Mr. Patel. Patel had timed his...
Is the answer yes or no?
The answer is yes, if he timed it.
Let's change the facts. Same facts, except that instead of Mr. Patel, it's Mr. Pyres, who is now the owner of Behol Inc., and also pays the rent throughout the term of the lease and then returns the keys. Any liability?
No.
No. So what exactly is the basis for liability here, aside from the fact that there were several months of unpaid rent, which apparently are not an issue but for the possibility of mitigation or acceleration arguments?
Two things. There was an anticipation by Mr. Jones.
I'm sorry?
There was an anticipation that Mr. Patel would, in fact, renew.
I can't hear you.
I said there was an anticipation by Shore that Patel would, in fact, renew. And that's clearly factually in the record.
He wasn't required to.
No, he wasn't required to, but it's a reasonable business expectation. And the default judgment against Patel should have established that. On the tortious interference with prospective relations.
I'm sorry, you're saying that in addition to the rent, there's liability for something more simply because your client thought that the original owner might renew?
That's the tort of prospective relationships, that as long as there's a reasonable probability and not just a hope, that would be that's an element of the tort.
But that requires some wrongdoing.
No.
In addition, doesn't it?
No. It does entail some.
What was the wrongdoing here?
Well, factually, I mean, you.
Let me ask you differently, Mr. You don't argue that Mr. Pyres had no right to acquire the stock of Mr. Patel, do you?
No, but he did not have.
And you don't argue that Mr. Pyres, particularly given the result of the Chancery case, had no legal right to apply for
under the lease,
liquor license, correct?
Under the lease, he had no right to apply for the change prior to the end of the lease. Right.
My question isn't it the case that the only thing that Mr. Pyres and or his entities did wrong was to close down the liquor store and not pay rent before the term of the lease expired, and perhaps caused some damage to the premises by not keeping the electricity and air conditioning on.
But what they did do was they accelerated the time in which they had a legal right to do what they did. And why is it?
Why can't a tenant go to the landlord and say, look, I can't operate this liquor store anymore. It's losing money. I'm going to give you back the keys. I'll pay you all the rent that's due. You're saying that Mr. Pierce couldn't have done that?
But that's not what he did.
I know it isn't what he did, but he could have, couldn't he?
But it's not what he did.
He could have, couldn't he?
He could have done that.
Or he could have turned the keys back. But
in order to do that, he'd have to turn the liquor license over to whoever he's surrendering the lease to. In order to shut down prematurely, he'd either have to surrender the license, okay, which, or he'd have to give the license
to
back.
To your client?
If he didn't want to abandon the license, that's correct.
The lease said that?
No. You're asking me a hypothetical. The hypothetical was, could Mr. Pierce just turn the keys back? Without losing the liquor license, he couldn't.
What I'm at a loss to understand is, what is it that Mr. Pierce did that would justify an award of anything, any damages other than the back rent and whatever premises damages were caused by premature shutting down of the
trial court found, and I think correctly, that there was tortious interference with the contract by reason of Mr. Pyrie's activities.
What?
Why? Mr. Pyrie's leased the next door structure. The lease was entered into in March of 2008. The first rent date was October the 16th. Before, and the lease that he committed himself to over a five-year term was approximately $1.2 million. In order to accomplish his plan, what he had to do is concurrently with, he had to obtain the license and move it.
He was entitled to do that.
But the contract says he didn't have the right to do that.
But the court refused to specifically enforce that contract. The Court of Chancery, in effect, held that he did have the right to do that, and the ABCC said he had the right to do that.
What the Chancery held was that there was an adequate remedy at law. We had raised tortious interference in Chancery Court, and the court said that we had an adequate remedy at law. It didn't expressly address the tortious interference claims, but those were before the Chancery Court, when the Chancery Court
dismissed. Well, the reason you had an adequate remedy at law is because the court said you don't have a specifically enforceable right to this liquor license.
And the
commission agreed. Because it allowed, over your client's objection, it approved a transfer of the liquor license or a grant of a new liquor license to the liquor store that was being operated or would be operated next door. So what's the tortious conduct here?
The tortious conduct was basically to direct, basically acquire a stranger to direct the stranger to breach.
Who's this?
Who's the
stranger?
The stranger is Mr. Pyrie's and his entities acquired B-hole for the sole purpose to allow B-hole to breach. The sole motivation of the transaction was to concurrently breach the lease of the license.
Okay, so you're actually arguing that in this case it was illegal for Mr. Pyrie's to acquire Mr. Patel's stock.
No.
Because he did it with an intention to cause the tenant to breach?
I'm not saying it was illegal to acquire the stock. What was illegal was to acquire the stock so that the lease could be breached. And again, the original hypothetical you gave was correct. Mr. Pyrie's wanted to wait the term of the lease, then everything would have been fine, but that's not what he did.
What's your understanding of the term efficient breach?
My understanding of the efficient breach is that a party to an existing contract can make the economic determination that it's an economic advantage to them to breach the contract and bear the consequences. in this particular instance, the consequences includes whatever tortious activity related to that efficient breach.
Well, help me understand the tortious activity as opposed to intentionally breaching the contract.
Again, the tortious activity is that you know there's a contract, you know about the contract, and you therefore, and you then cause the contract to be breached without justification. That's the tort.
No matter how efficient it may be to do it.
There's nothing about, well, you can potentially look at the 767 factors, which I think the trial court did. They were fully in front of the trial court, both in our opening brief. We mentioned the pattern instruction and said that that was a factual determination because there's mixed questions whether it's fact or law. It was also brought to the court's attention in the post or final briefs submitted by the appellants below, and they specifically listed the 767 factors. So those factors were before the court. The court understood those factors, and he found no justification. Whether he had to vet each one of those is a question for me, because in the recent, not it's the ASTI decision of this court in 2010, where the ASTI court overruled a Vice Chancellor Parsons' decision finding tortious interference without vetting each of the 767 factors.
So even though, as a matter of contract law, the doctrine of an efficient breach is recognized, a tortious interference can trump that and essentially abrogate that concept.
Yeah, because my understanding of the efficient breach, which again was not raised below, it was not, there was no mention of efficient breach below. So the trial court didn't have that fairly presented to them. What the trial court had presented was a contract, the Pirates entities knew about the contract. There was a causation, and there was no justification. None of the efficient breach theories were raised below. And I mean, that's just the case.
Well, efficient breach is not a defense. It's simply a term of art.
I mean,
there was a breach. There's no question about it. The question is, was that breach induced by some tortious conduct on the part of Mr. Pirates and or his entities?
Yeah, and again,
maybe I didn't hear it right, but tell me in a nutshell, what was the tortious conduct?
The tortious conduct was to acquire an entity so that the breach could occur. The way I expressed it in my written papers was if Mr. Pirates, okay, had directed Mr. Patel to transfer the license, and then I'll buy the stock. That's classic tortious interference. Reversing the facts shouldn't change the result.
Well, I'm having difficulty understanding. If you have the right to sell, if you're Patel and you have the right to sell the stock to Mr. Pirates' entities, and Mr. Pirates has the legal right to buy the stock and by doing so, takes over all rights and obligations under the lease, then declaring the lease in breach by whatever mechanism he used, acquiring the license, moving it, however you want to argue it, but willing to pay damages for the cost of breaching the lease, how does that become a tort?
It becomes a tort because you have third parties directing the breach. Third parties to the original contractor directing the breach.
Third party being Mr. Pirates?
Right.
Is the argument that Pirates and his entities didn't assume the rights and obligations of Mr. Patel under the lease?
No, that's not the argument. The argument is they did that, but they did that with the intent to breach. Well, the motive to breach the lease. I've got a few minutes left. Let me just turn to two or three things that I'd like.
Can I ask you a question on the damages awarded? One of the arguments being made is that the damages had to be limited to the rent accrued at the time of trial?
Right, and the trial court caveated that by saying that there's an offset in the event that there's a future rental. That's what he held in his thing. And there was, and again, the place is laid vacant until today. With respect to my argument about Mr. Patel on tortious interference with perspective, the court below entered a default judgment against Mr. Patel for both tortious interference and with an existing and prospective contract. The court below then found no damages for Mr. Patel. That's clearly an error because that liability was established. With respect to the punitive damage,
it was an error because if there was any tortious conduct, Mr. Patel had nothing to do with it.
No, Mr. Patel had a lot to do with it because it got.
But that's what the court found.
Pardon?
That's what the court found. Mr. Patel did not participate in any tortious conduct. You're disagreeing with that, but that's what.
What I'm saying is the court's finding was inconsistent by entering a default.
I'm just asking you whether that isn't what the court found.
The courts found that the court found that there was no participation. But what I'm saying is that's totally inconsistent with the entry of the default judgment prior, because that determined his liability. With respect to the two, if the court is inclined to uphold the punitive damage award, as our written papers say, the punitive damages did not accomplish the legal purpose for punitive damages. That's all I have. Thank you.
Do we typically recess for your part? That's what I
thought. Mr. Spence, can you clarify? One of the questions is what arguments that you're making now were or were not raised in the Superior Court. Was the mitigation argument that you're making now raised fairly?
Your Honor, I came up without my notebook. Hang on just a moment. I came without my notebook. I have to go grab it. Your Honor, I apologize. I am not sure that I can tell you off the top of my head without referring to the post-trial briefs written by the parties.
Okay, what about the acceleration argument or the no acceleration clause argument? Was that raised?
I believe that was raised in the post-trial briefs, but I'll be limited by whatever those post-trial briefs say.
You don't recall?
I didn't write them. I was not counsel of record at the trial. So I apologize. I don't recall off the top of my head, but I'm certainly bound by whatever the briefs raised. I wasn't really going to add much other than to suggest that our view remains the same, is that there was no finding by the trial court to show what was the egregious act, what was the misrepresentation, what was the fraud, what was the kind of know when you see it action that was taken by Mr. Pyres outside of the decision to make an application to move the liquor store next door that resulted in the punitive damage award. And we think either on a insufficient evidence or just as a clear error matter of law that there wasn't enough evidence in this record to support an award of punitive damages. And I don't really have a great deal to add beyond that unless there's other questions. And, of course, the briefs on all the other issues. But
thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and adjourn.